Good morning, Chairman. Stephen Mayne, I'm a small shareholder in Hawco, also a small shareholder in Hawco Equity, Head Record Realty, and one of the Rubicons. I've just got a couple of issues I want to draw out with you on how you're managing the conflicts of interest which come with this sort of blizzard of transactions we're having with our associated funds. Now, I've sort of got a sense from the CEO's comments that there's a little bit of investor reticence in terms of further committing to future funds. We've scaled back the fees in Record Realty as a sign of that. What I'm interested in is the related party transactions on page 127 of the annual report. And in some occasions on these, I'm on both sides as a shareholder in both vehicles. But they do look a little high in terms of the amount that you're drawing from each transaction. For instance, the property deal in the US, US $223 million, a fee for us of 14.6. In terms of the HIT, the auto HIT transaction, talks about a restructure or sale of a business in New Zealand. $29 million in revenue for us from that. And just specifically on that, there's no discussion of the value of the assets involved. So looking firstly at that New Zealand transaction, we got $29 million in revenue. What was the value of the asset that was actually dealt with there? I mean, there's no disclosure on that. It's just there's a related party transaction. We took out $29 million. What else can you tell us about that transaction as a start?
Okay, you can just repeat the two questions, Stephen, please.
Well, in all those related party transactions listed on page 127, the fees that we seem to be drawing out, for instance, another one is the wind energy deal, which says that we drew out revenues of $57.8 million on that. There's no disclosure of the value of the transaction. So there's an awful lot of related party transactions. There's no detail on the size of the assets or the value of the deals in the annual report. It just says that we're ripping out huge fees, which is great for us up front. But obviously, if we've now got reticence from the investors on the other side, there's a market confidence question about whether we're gouging these funds.
I understand. I mean, let me first give you the structure that's set up to ensure that the issues are addressed. We have a related party committee, which is chaired by Bob Mansfield, our deputy chairman and independent director. That committee reviews every single transaction where there is a potential for a related party to ensure that what occurs is done at arm's length. That committee clearly, in an organisation which involves the parent company, Alco, the manager and investor in each of the subsidiary funds, and we shouldn't forget Alco's philosophy is to be a significant shareholder in all of the funds it creates as well, so there is a clear alignment of interests. By us being a participant in the downstream vehicle, that is the management company. We're not there saying we're going to gouge out fees and not be sitting on the other side. And in fact, the brief that David Clark has, as the incoming CEO, is to ensure that every single one of our satellite funds gets back to performing extremely well with broad-based investor confidence. And why do I say that? I say that simply because the sustainability of your business model requires investor confidence in the downstream vehicle. So at a procedural level, I clearly don't sit on the related party committee, and nor should I, nor can I, but the related party committee reviews every single transaction and satisfies itself as to the arm's length nature of that. I'll hand over to Bob in case he has anything further to add on that point, Steve.
Thanks, Dave. Hi, Stephen. As chairman of the related party committee, I approach every single decision on the basis that if I was asked to stand up in a court of law and justify a decision from a process point of view, could I do it? And I'm sure I represent Sir Rod Ennington and also Barbara Ward with that same degree of responsibility we have in the related party issues that are involved with ALCA. There are a lot. I'd like to think in future years there might be fewer, but it is part and parcel, certainly the transition phase of the business, and would always be part of what we have to deal with in the ALCO business model. What do we look for? We look for total visibility. We look for total arm's length nature of the transactions. We look for market comparisons on every issue that are presented to us in relation to fees, interest rates, and any other charges that are involved. And the company secretary will vouch for the number of discussions that I have with him in relation to making sure that in some cases we just don't have one comparison, we have several, and we do absolute justice to that process, bearing in mind the very clear responsibilities that you're outlining. It's a fact of the business model, and as chairman of the committee, I can assure you we approach it with the utmost responsibility. With regard to the market, I think it is an understandable question, particularly when we haven't been around in the listed vein for as long as other companies have been that do have the same sort of related party challenge. We have to prove ourselves over time. I'm sure that the disciplines we've got in place will let us do that, and we look forward to getting to the stage when that question is still asked and the responsibility put on us, but we've proven that we've managed it effectively.
And Bob, how do you actually manage the meeting process? I mean, so Rod's one of the busiest men in the world. I was just in New York with him last week at the News Corp AGM. He's on Rio, he's chairman of Melbourne Major Events. He missed 4 of the 17 ordinary all-co board meetings this year. He's a very busy man. He wasn't able to make it to the Rio EGM a month ago in Melbourne. Lives in Melbourne. Barbara and yourself are in Sydney. You've all attended 47 out of 47. So what exactly constitutes a meeting of the Related Party Transactions Committee? Are you just on a phone hookup? You've been faxed all the documents? I mean, because there's very complex transactions. You're very busy people. You've had 47 meetings during the year. What actually constitutes a meeting? Just take me through this. I mean, Rubicon, massive Related Party transaction. Clearly, you must have had a meeting before you'd sign off on the deal. So just how did that process
Absolutely.
Work?
It's not as complex as what you are suggesting, because it's very common sense how you approach it. The basic facts are distributed by management to the committee. The committee can interact with the company secretary from any legal aspects or clarification aspects, or the management itself to answer any questions they've got, which they do independently. There are some that are run-of-the-mill transactional issues that are pretty easy to do. There are others, such as Rubicon, where there's a lot of time and effort applied to the situation. Face-to-face meetings, if possible. If Rod Eddington can't attend, he's always available at a phone call from myself and Barbara for a joint conference call. And we recognise the challenges you're talking about. It's part and parcel of being a global company, and we have to execute to that sense of responsibility I outlined earlier.
How many deals have you knocked back?
As far as, I mean, knocking back totally, probably only a couple. As far as questioning, I'd say close to all that have been presented have been questioned for comparables and visibility and all the rest of it.
Because the whole Macquarie defence is that, you know, they've released all these statistics. We've looked at 100, and, I don't know the figures, but we've looked at 100-something transactions with MIG, and we've only done 30. You know, they actually, that's the way they prove it. And they talk about their independent directors on various funds rather than the independent directors on Macquarie. So you're saying you've got an independent directors group on Orco, which has knocked back, 2 out of 49. And, I mean, I heard Jeff Morgan give a talk yesterday. He was the only independent director on Orco Equity Partners during the Qantas transaction. So, you know, he's just one lonely guy sitting there with all our related party transactions and with Orco Equity Partners talking about putting $1 billion into Qantas. So,
Stephen, just to correct you, there were two independent directors.
Okay.
Mark Sterling's
So I know that Macquarie talks up all their independent directors on the various funds. So I would have thought that you need two sides of this transaction, and you, rather than a strike rate of 98% in terms of our esteemed independent related party transaction committee, that the fact that you're signing off such a huge proportion, that the related party fees are so huge that various of the funds are now trading at big discounts, I think we've got a market sort of a reputational question here over our structure, and obviously dealing with it with Record, but it's just we've probably hit the share price, and I just think.
Stephen, can I just mention two things, mate? On firstly, we're talking here today as ALCO. Separately, each of the entities that does a downstream externally managed fund has its own RE, and that RE in turn used to us. At that level of each of the RE level, which REs are majority controlled by independent directors, there's a lot of transactions that do not proceed. Okay? And when we come to the ALCO board, and the RPC, it is only the independent directors who vote with respect to any transaction that has a related party element to it. So there is no involvement whatsoever by any of the executives in any related party deal as it relates to it, to ALCA. And you've got to see the other side of the coin as well, which is our RFEs being predominantly RFML, MFL and AML. Those three REs review absolutely independently each transaction. So the RPC looks at the related party number purely from an ALCA point of view. Stephen, do you mind?
One more point. I'll sit down after this. I'll get up on the other resolutions. But the $750 million in loans that we have outstanding back to us, just one line here in the report, you've mentioned the figure of, I think, $150 has been linked to the Rubicon Group. Can you tell us a bit more about where all those other loans are and your total debt figures? I mean, I have to find this, it's dizzyingly confusing in terms of understanding your finances. Okay. What is, across all your assets, what's your total debt? Macquarie's saying they're $120 to $150 bill. What's your total debt right across the assets? And actually, how many funds are there? I mean, I just can't keep up. There seems to be 20 or 30 funds. How many funds are there? What's the total debt? And can you tell us more about these loans that are due back to us at some point?
Okay, thanks, Steve. Good question. Let me just say that the board and the new management team is tasked to address this. It's a very significant issue. We're getting investor confidence back in our management, in our managed funds, and seeing them perform back to NTA and above is very, very important to us. And there's a huge amount of effort that will be going into achieving that as well as driving our business going forward. We can't have one without the other, but we clearly can't have the lack of investor confidence in our managed funds businesses without that impacting psychologically on our ability to raise future capital. So they're very important questions. I guess with respect to the total debt, let me just, I don't want to black box things here because David clearly articulated we're not black box, but there's a very big difference between on-balance sheet debt and off-balance sheet debt. The off-balance sheet debt for our businesses is that part of the debt involved in all of our ownership transactions where there is no recourse other than to the asset by the bank lenders. Now, that will represent anything between 50 and up to 95% of the total acquisition cost, depending on the long-term nature of the lease and the bank's view as to the residual value of those assets. That is, however, knows it in the accounts, because under AFRIS rules, we do bring it on balance sheet, but we do note that that is non-recourse. Separate from that, the true debt on our balance sheet is the sum of our total working capital facilities with a number of syndicated banks and our sub-debt. Now, that figure is just on $1 billion, and that's a come-and-go facility, and our gearing ratios, therefore, on balance sheet fluctuate between about 40 and 55%, depending on how drawn we are. So in terms of gearing, I just want you all to understand there is a vast difference between the on-balance sheet gearing, when there is recourse from the banks to our balance sheet, and that figure's in the 40 to 55% range, as I said, depending on how drawn we are under the debt facilities, and the off-balance sheet nature. So the total debt, Chris, I don't have the figures in front of me, but have you got the answers there, mate? Yeah. On a gross basis, just to answer Stephen's question. $8 billion, of which $1 billion is on balance sheet, i.e. full recourse, and $7 billion is non-recourse. Okay. Thanks for those questions. I mean, it is an important issue, and I just want to make everyone to understand that this is a critical and important element to David and Michael Stefanowski's tasking and carrying out the improvement of the satellite fund we've created. And please be assured that ALCO taking control of AEP, ALCO coming out and saying we're reviewing what we're doing with Record Realty, ALCO undertaking to review NACS, ALCO undertaking to examine every one of our satellite funds, they're not empty promises, they're real promises, because it's important that there's a balance between both us as a parent company and the satellite fund. Are there any other questions on that?
Look, just on Gordon's re-election, my first issue is his presence on the Remuneration Committee. Along with yourself, Chairman, we've only got one independent director on the Remuneration Committee. So effectively, we've got two executives, the two kings of related party transactions within our empire, both sitting in judgment of the size of the bonuses going to the management team which originate many of these related party transactions. I would have thought that determining size of bonus for our executive team is something that you, Chairman, and Gordon should absolutely not be involved with or have a majority on the committee. And as much as we all like Bob, he's an independent director of one, along with two heavily conflicted directors on the committee. So why is Gordon on the remuneration committee?
Again, another good question, Stephen, and it comes back to when we first established the board, Gordon was classified as non-executive, not independent. And you referred to the workload of Rod Eddington and a number of other directors. The reason we're adding additional numbers is exactly the point that you're pointing out now, that we need to spread the responsibility amongst the board members in a truly non-executive, non-independent way in what the future holds. At the moment, in relation to the conduct of the Remuneration Committee, obviously I access external references very closely with Ernst & Young and also at times John Egan's organisation, but it's not the way it should be for the future, and that will be addressed.
Okay, the other issue is with this Rubicon transaction, Gordon will become an executive of the company. I think that it's important to get a fifth independent director, but probably more important is actually to reduce the number of executive directors on the board. I mean, there's not many companies that have four or five executive directors on their board. Babcock and Macquarie both do it, and it's one of the issues that the government's advisors bang on about a lot. So what is the argument, for instance, for having Mr. Stefanowski and Gordon on the board as executive directors going forward when their ranking is sort of 3, 4, or 5 down the pecking order? The conventional approach would be to have one or two executives, not 4 or 5.
Well, just at an intellectual level, in an intellectual level, on behalf of Cordell and Michael, I'm going to fundamentally question that assumption. look, Stephen, I'm a very, very firm believer that talent, wherever it's found, should be nurtured, should be welcomed, and should be actively encouraged at all board levels. I'm not a believer in having, I often quote, my next door neighbour's dog is independent. My next door neighbour's dog on the board would satisfy a number of box ticking exercises. That achieved nothing for anyone. What's appropriate is the balance between independence and talent. Too much talent with no independence, bad thing. Too much independence, no talent, worse thing. We will ensure that there is a balance between talent and independence. We will actively review the composition of the board, and we do that with external advisors. And clearly, Rubicon transactions that have been announced 2 days ago, and part of the total board review, which we do every year, will be to look at the composition and ensure the skill set and the independence are both fully reviewed, and that we believe we have the optimum structure. We've already stated today we believe the majority of independence is important, but whether that means that we will take talent off the board simply to satisfy box-ticking exercise is something this board will review on behalf of the shareholders, not on behalf of our new stewards.
I think you could invite numbers 3, 4, or 5 to attend board meetings, but I think this company clearly has a governance credibility problem. And when you talk about the share price of your various trusts, that goes to the heart of it.
Yes,
and that's why you need 7 non-execs and maybe 2 or 3 execs max. And I think it's an issue that you should review.
Thank you for your views.
Stephen, just one final comment on that, if I could. And again, I take your point. Obviously, in talking to potential candidates for a new position, that's a very obvious question that's being posed at the same time. So it's not the first time it's been brought up. And secondly, the review process for the board's modus operandi in the last 12 months, we're just midstream now of reviewing the results of that, and these issues could rise again. So it's very much on the table. And as David said, the principles that he's espoused is wise where it's at the moment.
I suggest you probably have to pay a bit more to get another couple of nets, because this company is incredibly complex and controversial. Someone like Sir Rod, amazing reputation, 47 related party transaction committees for $165,000 a year. A lot of people would ask why Rod would bother.
So I think you're probably going to have to look at bigger pay packets and better government structures.
That is being recorded for next year's meeting. Absolutely. I do value the question because it's a very current one being applied to me as heading up the committee to come back with extra directors. And the other fact that you touched on earlier, Steve, on the workload of directors right now with the company in this state of growth, this state of transition is quite considerable.
This will be my last contribution. Partly relates to the remuneration report, but also relates to this. So if you do come back to the REM report, I won't get up and I'll ask it now. These issues are relatively modest in the scheme of Orco, 1.59 million shares, probably worth about 12 mil. And I noticed that your remuneration report had 98-99% in support, so clearly your institutional shareholders don't have any problems with your remuneration policies. 7.5 million voted against Gordon, I think, which is a message you should all heed. The specific question is... last year, page 25 of the annual report, we granted fair value of $81.75 million worth of options and shares to our executives. That's a big whack. How many of the people who are going to receive this year's allocations shared in that $82 million pool that they got last year? And the related question, David, I know you like complexity, Mr. Chairman, but even your own shareholding in Orco is about as clear as mud in understanding it.
That's the company's code, not me, Stephen.
Well, I have to say, I tried reading page 119 and understanding what on earth's going on, and I've just got no idea. But the line where it says APT, you're deemed to have an interest in 45.8 million shares, the majority of which are collateralised. Now, what's happening here? You've hocked your share, or you've given your shares as security, the majority of them. Is that suggesting you've got your geared to your eyeballs on your own shareholder? So why aren't the majority of your shares collateralised? That's what it
is. I won't go into huge complex detail, but just let me say very simply, the rules of the Companies Code require you to define what is a relevant interest. As I have a 24-25% beneficial interest in Alcoast Principles Trust, I'm required to consolidate the whole 45 million spend. Okay? Right. And that's as simple as that. APT itself, then, in terms of the fundraising it's done with Water Hybrids, used some of those shares that were part of the deal we did in April 2005. To collateralise the repayment obligations to the hybrid holders. So those were part of the collateral provided for the acquisition of the shares in AFG that APT undertook in 2005. That was when APT bought those shares at around $5.25. There's no other collateral. There's no hocking by me, the eyeballs of my shareholders.
Yeah, can I just make a distinction, because we are mixing this resolution with the remuneration comments, and I'm not suggesting you want to avoid it. Your question on the 80 minutes from last year and the people involved, David,
have you either done? I actually, I'll come back to that soon. I just genuinely don't know. I think I'll need to look at the report and come back to it. Yeah, it sounds to me, the figure sounds very like the shares that were issued to the vending shareholders of Alco as a result of the merger of Alcoa and Red.